This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. It's good to have your company on this Sunday afternoon. Stay tuned. WMRA's Jordy Yeager takes us back to a tense weekend in Lexington, which saw two different kinds of celebrations in the days leading up to the King holiday. One parade celebrated the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The other, an older tradition peculiar to Virginia, celebrating Lee Jackson Day. We also head to the Chesapeake Bay for a look at a problem you may not have heard of. Crab traps that get lost in the water and pose a real hazard for creatures that get caught in them. The story of the so-called ghost crab pots coming up. We'll also have a roundup of the week's news from the General Assembly session in Richmond and WMRA's Our Island Universe, too. But first, at this time of great political change and uncertainty, some Charlottesville residents have been looking to history for direction. Their guide is the writer James Baldwin, as WMRA's Miranda Bennett reports.
Writing during and after the Civil Rights Movement, James Baldwin is known for his piercing examination of the consequences of racial injustice and his call to all Americans, both black and white, to live up to the country's ideals. And Mark Bell isn't surprised that there's been a resurgence of interest in his writing.
I think, like a lot of people, I have been listening to and reading some Ta-Nehisi Coates. He sometimes offhandedly quotes Baldwin, and I go, whoa, wait a minute, what's he talking about? And then I go, and that's really what got me interested in reading some more Baldwin. I think it's worth more discussion.
And he got the chance to have that discussion this past weekend when the Jefferson School for African American Heritage hosted a public discussion of James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. It was led by Xavier Pickett, who's a pre-doctoral fellow at the University of Virginia.
I'm kind of approaching this reading as an opportunity to explore Baldwin, which is really an opportunity to explore America itself, and it's really considered the soul of this nation, and particularly given, you know, recent events of the elections and just the past few years of the tumultuous sort of time. You know, it's a moment of kind of deep soul reflection, and not just reflection, but hopefully to act in more effective ways to be able to, as Baldwin would say, to achieve our country.
And that was a concern that many of the discussion expressed. How do we build a better country? Although James Baldwin wrote The Fire Next Time more than 50 years ago, Carly Margolis, another participant, felt like he could have been writing about this moment. She read the book
and was so struck by its resonance. I can't even, you know, I came up in the conversation that he has lost no relevance. Even down to the choice of language that he uses about white America is just, it's perfectly precise to what we're currently experiencing.
And according to Pickett, Baldwin's writing remains pertinent because of his preoccupation with how we understand our past, a past that we still haven't reckoned with collectively as a country.
There's a way in which we've never, in fact, progressed, and the past has always, has always been something that we've tried to avoid and ignore, and never actually to grapple with, you know, look it in his face.
And throughout the discussion, many participants did talk about feeling a personal and social obligation to really confront the country's racist foundations. And as Baldwin notes, there's no way to become fully aware of the pain of the past without changing our institutions and ourselves.
Baldwin is really calling us into a future, calling us to a higher self, a self that we cannot imagine, we have not imagined, that we've never thought we could actually become.
And the reading group found a strategy for action in the final words of the book.
Everything now, we must assume, is in our hands. We have no right to assume otherwise.
If we, and now I mean the relatively conscious whites and the relatively conscious blacks, who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of the others, do not falter in our duty now.
We may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world.
For WMRA News, I'm Miranda Bennett.
Another American writer, William Faulkner, famously wrote that the past is never dead. It's not even past. And nowhere is that more evident than in Lexington, Virginia. A tale of two cities played out there last weekend as rival groups took to the streets to celebrate two very different holidays, Lee Jackson Day and Martin Luther King Jr. Day. WMRA's Jordy Yeager was there.
On the third weekend in January, for years, these bagpipes have trickled through Lexington's downtown. A state holiday for more than a century, Virginia celebrates the birthdays of Civil War generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, both of whom are buried in Lexington. The city's often called the Shrine of the South. But this year, there is a new sound in the streets.
Who is Lexington?
We are Lexington.
Whose community?
Our community.
More than 1,000 people braved the near-freezing, rainy January morning to hold Lexington's first parade in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Saturday. It was organized by a group called CARE, the Community Anti-Racism Education Initiative, which was launched in March after a series of Ku Klux Klan recruitment pamphlets were found on local lawns. It struck a raw nerve in a city where Confederate flags are commonplace. TJ Talley helped organize the parade. He teaches history at Washington and Lee University.
I think that it's been a series of tensions here in a town that is known for its Civil War heritage and has every right to be proud of the fact that it's a historic town and place, but also where many of its citizens want to be an inclusive city that makes all people feel welcome.
Robin LeBlanc agrees. She's lived in Lexington for nearly 2 decades and says she's fed up with Confederate celebrations, most of which are attended by people from out of state. And so, CARE preempted the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the Virginia Flaggers and secured the city's sole parade permit for Saturday.
So I know there's some local folks who want to celebrate a war of 160 years ago and in a regime that had slaves, but most of us aren't those people. And we were hiding out, literally. But here we are today. We're not hiding anymore.
LeBlanc coordinated the parade's security and logistics. People gathered beforehand by the Randolph Street United Methodist Church. Old and young carried peace flags, Black Lives Matter posters, and signs that read, "Say no to hate." LeBlanc took to her megaphone and reminded them that they were flying in the face of tradition and that there may be people along the way who don't approve.
This parade is a peaceful, family-oriented parade. That means we have an absolute rule of non-engagement. You don't see hecklers. Don't look them in the eye. Don't show them your flag. The flags are for us, and your banners are for us. We don't hear hecklers, and we do not speak to hecklers.
The parade lasted about an hour with no hecklers. As parade-goers marched downtown, the Virginia flaggers hoisted a giant Confederate battle flag about a mile away outside a gun store. They later brought scores of flags to the Stonewall Jackson Cemetery. Barry Eisenhower is the group's spokesman.
What this flag and everything actually stands for, what it actually is, I mean, that is one of the things that people don't realize. This is a Confederate battle flag. It was never government issued, if you will. And it stood for the soldier, i.e. the veteran, the Confederate veteran. They fought under this in battle, and it represents our veteran soldiers. It doesn't represent anything else.
Lacking an official parade permit, about 150 people marched with the Virginia flaggers down Main Street's sidewalk less than an hour after the King Parade. Several protesters near the cemetery held signs that read, "Smash white supremacy." But otherwise, the march was uneventful and ended with a gathering in a downtown park. This was B.C. Johnson's first year coming, but he's been to similar events throughout the country. He was the only Black person in attendance.
I kind of got tired of the, you know, flag debate growing up in South Carolina. I just, you know, started doing some independent reading, and, you know, we ended up learning the true meaning of the secession instead of what we were taught by Yankee-written, federally supported history books.
For Johnson, supporting the Confederate flag is not about racism. It's not even about race. It's about supporting the right to dissent and honoring those who died to protect that right. Johnson recently discovered that his ancestors fought in the Civil War. The next day, on Sunday, the Sons of Confederate Veterans held its 17th annual celebration of Lee and Jackson's birthdays. Local retired state police officer W.B. Wilmore spoke to the crowd of nearly 200. An unsuccessful candidate for Rockbridge County Board of Supervisors 10 years ago, Wilmore called attendees to action, pointing his finger at CARE.
We're being invaded again. It's 1864 all over again. And, of course, the invaders are a little more subtle this time. They've got money. They've got some brains, not many.
Wilmore listed a lengthy series of ways the city was changing for the worse. Suggestions to rename two local streets, Confederate Circle and Rebel Ridge. The removal of a Stonewall Jackson portrait from the local hospital, which bears Jackson's name. Local resident Brandon Dorsey agreed, saying that for all of CARE's talk about inclusivity, they made the Sons of Confederate Veterans feel very unwelcome. Dorsey is a communication officer with the group's local chapter.
They knew what they were doing, so, you know, it definitely hypocritical. And if they weren't seeking confrontation, they would have chosen another time. So, you know, when they come out and try to play innocent, it's not the case.
The group paraded down Main Street, solemnly marching as a handful of supporters waved from the sidewalks. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
We're going to head to Virginia's Eastern Shore now, where every year Chesapeake Bay watermen toss about 600,000 traps overboard to catch one of our favorite delicacies, the blue crab. But inevitably, some of those traps called crab pots disappear. They become so-called ghost pots that kill millions of crabs and other marine species trapped inside. Watermen used to spend winters searching for those pots, but federal funds to pay for the project dried up. So scientists are looking at other ways to deal with the problem. Pamela D'Angelo with Virginia Public Radio has this report.
Daniel Knott is a newcomer to Virginia's crabbing industry. After 22 years as a helicopter pilot in the Army, he decided to return to the waters where he once worked with his grandfather. This fall, after putting out 50 crab pots, he returned to find only 25.
So some of those were probably lost due to storms and getting rolled around and losing the buoy or something, or boats coming through and cutting your lines, you know, by accident or, you know, on purpose. You just don't know, because there is some territorial aspects of it as well. I'm the new guy on the block, so I have to earn my rite of passage there.
Knott has a total of 200 crab pots. Some are covered with vinyl to extend their life in the salty bay. But if one of them goes missing, it becomes a death trap, where captured marine life die, attracting other animals. The cycle can go on for years.
If I were to lose my buoy off of it, this pot is going to sit at the bottom of the bay and catch crab, turtle, fish, everything, until it completely deteriorates and falls apart.
There are about 145,000 derelict crab pots bay-wide. Some 58,000 are lost in Maryland and 87,000 in Virginia. Lay them end to end, and they'd stretch 53 miles. That's from Havre de Grace to Tillman Island in Maryland, or from the mouth of the Potomac River to the mouth of the bay in Virginia. Over the past 10 years, NOAA has been awarding grants to remove derelict fishing gear. States pay watermen to locate and remove pots during the winter. In Virginia, where dredging for hibernating crabs in the winter is no longer allowed, that meant some work for watermen like Richard Green.
But I was a little skeptical in the beginning. I just thought it was just a free-for-all, a giveaway, just something to do, give us up, keep us quiet, you know, that type of thing. But I seen good come out of it. I seen, you know, we started getting some of the pots up, and they started figuring out how many crabs you could have saved, you know. It kind of kept us going through the winter month.
The Virginia Institute of Marine Science says over 6 years, removal of the so-called ghost pots increased bay-wide crab harvests, adding $33.5 million to the industry. Now, VIMS is working on other solutions, like preventing buoy lines for crab pots from being accidentally cut in areas heavily used by both commercial and recreational boaters. Donna Bilkovic, a scientist with VIMS, says continued prevention and removal efforts will end the ghost fishery that is competing with the active fishery.
One other thing is some type of biodegradable escape panel. So if a pot is lost, that will go away and any animals captured can then get out of the pot.
Daniel Knott has already installed the panels on his pots.
You know, to me, it's just my way of doing a little bit. Kind of like Dr. Seuss, the Lorax. Just do a little bit, and every little bit will count.
I'm Pamela D'Angelo for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative.
Let's turn our attention now to the business of lawmaking in the state capitol. One of the higher-profile issues there last week, the death by starvation of a mentally ill man at the Hampton Roads Regional Jail in 2015, is now prompting lawmakers to take action in Richmond. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has the story.
The family of Jermichael Mitchell was in Richmond to lobby lawmakers to take action now. They don't want his death behind bars at the Hampton Roads jail to be in vain. Now, his aunt, Roxanne Adams, says now is the time to take action.
We ask that real changes be implemented at Virginia jails to prevent another mentally ill young man like Jermichael Mitchell from dying.
Democratic Senator Barbara Favola of Arlington is pushing a bill that would require mental health training for all correctional officers at Virginia jails. The idea is that they would be able to recognize the signs of mental illness, signs like Jamichael Mitchell slowly starving while he was incarcerated for stealing $5 worth of snacks.
Now is the opportunity for us to make our voices heard. It's sometimes so unfortunate we have to suffer a horrific tragedy to move the policy agenda forward.
Other bills under consideration include mental health screening for all inmates, requiring the state to investigate deaths at jails, and allowing police to take mentally ill suspects to seek help rather than locking them up behind bars. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Last week was the first full week of business for the 2017 General Assembly session. To talk about some of the other activities in the state capitol, here's Craig Carper with our partner station WCVE in Richmond, talking with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
As the country is waiting to see how the new president will govern, Virginians are wondering how his policies will affect the Commonwealth.
The new president and his administration will have implications for Virginia's politics and Virginia's economy. There's a Republican gubernatorial primary underway, and three of the four prospects are happily invoking the name of Donald Trump. One is not, Ed Gillespie, the perceived frontrunner, keeping in mind that more than 55% of self-identified Republican voters are undecided on their choice for the nomination. But certainly in Gillespie's case, he's clearly attempting to simultaneously position himself for the primary and the general election by making sort of occasional acknowledgments of Mr. Trump's ascension and what it means for the nation in terms of a Republican-dominated federal government. Frank Wagner, a member of the Senate, Denver Riggleman, a distiller no one's heard from but has a wonderful last name from Nelson County, and most notably Corey Stewart, are not at all reluctant to align very publicly with Donald Trump. In fact, Corey Stewart, who lost his job as state Trump chairman during the campaign for attempting to out-Trump Trump, is placing the first television ads of the primary season, and they're going to be running adjacent to the television coverage of the Trump inaugural. As to the economy, we've got a big hole in the state budget, about $1.5 billion. This is largely a consequence of the aftershocks of sequestration, that big fancy word for those automatic across-the-board spending cuts at the federal level. Trump wants to spend more money on defense. Virginia already leads the nation in terms of defense dollars spent, $55 billion a year. The departing governor, Terry McAuliffe, talks about weaning Virginia from its seeming over-reliance on the federal budget. What if Trump prevails with all of these promises to increase defense spending? Does that not mean that Virginia will ultimately become even more dependent on federal largesse? And it's considerable, 24, 25, 26%, depending on how one does one's arithmetic, as a percentage of the state economy.
As we complete the first full week of the General Assembly session, partisan battles are in full effect.
Yes, and sometimes they are among members of the majority party. The infamous North Carolina-type bathroom bill got the flush from a Republican-controlled subcommittee. Bob Marshall, very socially conservative Republican legislator from Northern Virginia who'd been pushing it, very upset. He couldn't get as much as a vote out of this general laws subcommittee. Clearly, Republicans in a legislative election year don't want to have to answer for this embarrassment, despite the very conservative makeup of the Republican electorate. North Carolina is still living down this measure, and Virginia Republicans don't want to find themselves, shall we say, similarly conflicted. Governor McAuliffe had indicated that if that bill came anywhere near his desk, he'd be vetoing it. The Republicans killed a number of bills to clear obstacles to voting. That includes McAuliffe's proposed repeal of that voter photo ID bill. The Republicans pushed through the House on a party line vote, a very symbolic bill, declaring a day of tears that would allow local governments to fly at half-staff flags to protest death by abortion. There was a defeat in a Senate committee, also in a party line, of a Democratic bill that would have allowed illegal immigrants to procure a special type of driver's license. The immigrant community and immigrant advocates say this is absolutely necessary for immigrants in the process of getting their affairs organized to have access to bank accounts, to hire out post office boxes to the Republicans. That's another bridge too far.
And a high-profile conservative commentator has said she may challenge Senator Tim Kaine in 2018.
Laura Ingraham, one of the conservative pundits, also a figure instrumental in the defeat of Eric Cantor in the 2014 primary against Dave Brat. Ingraham saying on Fox, a conservative network with which she is affiliated, that she's thinking about taking on Tim Kaine in 2018. It seems that the Trump victory, despite his defeat in Virginia, is instilling a certain measure of bravado among possible Republican candidates, including Laura Ingraham.
And finally, a bill that would require Dominion Virginia Power as well as Appalachian Power to refund about $45 to the average customer each year for overcharges has been killed.
Yes, and this is a bill that calls attention to Dominion's considerable influence in the General Assembly. It throws around a lot of money, fields an army of lobbyists, and with little difficulty succeeded in convincing a very friendly Senate committee to kill a bill that would have restored full State Corporation Commission oversight of the power company. There were maybe two votes in favor of this bill. It's very interesting that Republicans, given the rising populism in their party, their supposed defense of the little man, were still quite devoted to the defense of the big boys, and that includes Dominion Virginia Power.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
I'm Chanel Barani, and this is Our Island Universe. NASA and NOAA have independently concluded that Earth's surface temperatures were the warmest since modern record-keeping began in 1880. The planet's average surface temperature has risen about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 19th century, a change largely driven by increased carbon dioxide and other human-made emissions into the atmosphere. While we debate the science of climate change, our planet is changing in ways that will have enormous impact to our species and the generations to come. Science is driven by evidence. Every national academy in the United States has now endorsed the science of climate change and that it is driven by our continued use of fossil fuels. There is no debate in the scientific community. It's important to note that while the sea levels rise and our climate changes, our planet will still be here. The Earth will be fine. Other species will adapt to changing conditions. What will we do? What kind of planet will our grandkids and our great-grandkids inherit? In order to effect real change, we need to stop attacking science and process the results of decades of fossil fuel use that has fundamentally altered our climate. Again, our planet will still be here. Our planet will adapt to new changes, like it always has. Will we? I'm Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. Follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.